we're starting the Carolyn Guertin portion. Carolyn, what are your opening commentaries?
Well, actually, I came across a Huffington Post where, did you know that Peyton Manning has been accused of leading a doping ring?
That would be the football player?
Uh-huh.
Really? He's getting caught? Definitely caught?
Yeah, there's some documentary now. When I looked a little, I'm just reading the head. It said Al Jazeera was promoting this story. So they're, Al Jazeera is after us now, Bob.
Well, after football players, you mean?
Yeah, yeah. It's not just Hollywood or the bikini-clad models. They're after the football players now.
And they're doing a journalistic investigation and exposing them. They've joined up with Sherman Skolnick and Mae Brussel.
Right.
And Lynn LaRouche, okay?
Yeah. Explosive documentary links Peyton Manning to doping ring. An Indianapolis anti-aging clinic supplied quarterback Peyton Manning with human growth hormone, a performance-enhancing drug banned by the NFL. Pharmacist who once worked at the clinic asserts in a new special report from Al Jazeera's investigative unit.
Well, how does
this relate? Everybody's going down, Bob.
So how does this relate to Carolyn Guertin's theme, digital prohibition?
It's digital probing. Like Ian would say, they're digital probing the football players now.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Everybody's being probed. Nothing is sacred. Okay, now what's interesting about this section of digital prohibition that I read, it's all within a few pages of the content. So you go to page 123, Bob. And it may be, 122 to 124, because my online version could be different. And it's about the word portal. It's not really a deep discussion, but just look for Bouriard, B-O-U-R-R-I-A-U-D, who says, the contemporary work of art does not position itself as the termination point of the creative process, bracket, a finished product to be contemplated, bracket, but as a site of navigation, a portal, a generator of activities. We tinker with production, we surf on a network of signs, we insert our forms on existing lines. So all I'm bringing up here is just the rampant use of the word portal in current content. And they throw around the word portal as if it means something, but I don't know what it means to most people. It's like O.J. was saying about words, you know, we don't even know what they mean when they're said, but they are powerful. So I think by throwing around the word portal in the media, it does open people up to the possibility that we could be visiting other worlds. What do you think, Bob? I'll mute.
Well, that's the chip body world. Ian says the kids they wouldn't have any problem with what Ian's saying about portals, otherworldly portals that your chemical body goes to, but they would think it would be within their chip body experience. They understand portal as a chip body transitional vehicle, and so they may not get, as we discussed with some of the young chip body people last night, when you actually talk about their physical body going through portals, they don't agree with that. They do agree that they are shifting maybe in their mind to other worlds, digital created spaces. So I want to read what you read over again just to make it clear. Carolyn Guertin, in the book, page 123, says, according to French theorist Nicolas Bouriot, art is no longer the termination point. Instead, the artistic process is about post-production. The goal is to start a conversation, and it is in the process of conversing that art is born. No longer is there an original object to bow down to. Instead, all participants are potentially equals in the conversation. Well, that statement, I wrote my name beside that. That's been my policy since the 80s, right? The conversing is the art, not any conclusion or any stupid recording that comes out of it or some definite artifact. Then Baudrillard says, the contemporary work of art does not position itself as the termination point of the creative process. And creative process in quotes, and then he defines the creative process as a finished product to be contemplated. So maybe art does not position itself as the termination point of the creative process. And in brackets, the finished product to be contemplated. So the finished product means is relating to the termination point. So there can be another kind of creative process. So the work of art is a site of navigation, a portal, a generator of activities. We tinker with production. We surf on a network of signs. We insert our forms on existing lines. This may be why, Carolyn, in your video summits you're always doing with new people. People invite you on to their TV, their, what are they called? Video summits?
Audio or video summits.
Yeah. They have a nice, clear definition of what the show is about. But when they actually get into talking to you, they're lazy, they don't really know where they're going to go with it, and they come up with totally different content than that maybe their definition in their website stated. But that's what this sentence means. People tinker with production. We surf on a network of signs. We insert our forms on existing lines. We basically wing it, improvise it, and that is the normal way of being creative today.
Right. So putting finished product in quotes means partly that you can't. There is no finish line. There's no beginning, no ending, all that stuff. Whereas when you had a sculpture or painting, you thought that was the end of it. And even that wasn't the end of it, because then it becomes what the viewer thinks about the sculpture or painting.
Yeah, Duchamp said art becomes public property after the old kind of art. The object art became public property after 30 years, and it was out of the artist's and the critic's hands.
So, yeah, that was interesting what you said about the teenagers just thinking that the portal means about their chip bodies. But I think, to me, it's kind of opening up the possibility that it could be about their physical bodies, too.
Well, Ian says they're going to get... They can handle that idea once they realize it's something different from their chip body experience, because they've mimed it in the chip body already.
Right.
So they're definitely open to it. They're not like those stick-in-the-mud scientists that OJ's complaining about from the last 100 years.
Mm-hmm.
So what did you want to say about this?
So I'm good now. I just focused on the word portal and what that evoked.
Yeah, well, you have a specific, unique meaning for it,
mm-hmm.
which some people before the chip body who studied the occult might mean it that way. It had more special meaning, a more limited meaning, but it's slung around in the chip world as normal slang, portals. So they're always talking about portaling.
Right. But then something you brought up about what Baudrillard is saying, the collaborative nature of work. I'm still reading the Patti Smith book, and her whole premise in this book is describing how she, Patti Smith, and Robert Mapplethorpe defined their lives in relation to each other and their art. They both supported each other's art right from the beginning when they were in, 20, 21 years old. So maybe that's expressing sort of the meme of the time where instead of an artist just trying to find a sponsor to support them, then people went out and did more collaborative work. But I'll take that back, because Robert Mapplethorpe, he absolutely had to wait around for a sponsor to support him. What was it? Sam somebody other. Do you know the...
Sam Shepard, the playwright.
No, that was...
Oh.
He was a friend of...
Patti Smith.
It was Sam Wagstaff.
I don't know that name.
Yeah.
Well, he was a guy with money? That
guy
became
with money,
a sponsor,
yeah.
I see. Okay. I didn't know that. So back to this thing about Patti and Robert Mapplethorpe supporting each other. It's like McLuhan said that music was a corporate art form in the 19th century. People use it to take their visual bias and massage it with big orchestras and big operas and that. So they get massaged by acoustic space. But then in the 60s, McLuhan said an interesting thing. He said music no longer served a corporate ritual, corporate purpose. It became a private concern. That's the kids arguing over which band is better, which group is better, which is more spiritual or non-spiritual. And so I'm thinking that the Gutenberg art world, the object art world, was obsolete by the 60s, but the young people turned it into a private concern and made it a dialogue between them and their buddies, their friends. You see? She and Robert made it a personal therapy for themselves, personal psychic support, gearing themselves up for presenting their image in the TV landscape. Back then, you know, they're all saying, well, at some point I'm going to get interviewed by Andy Warhol or Time Magazine, and that's what
they lived for.
They lived to get to that level. So meanwhile, it was a private concern, the art. And so it was not about art as it became, which was advertising. Advertising became the bona fide art form of the corporate ritual that art usually is. Even though people say it lacked the aura of special, unique ideas or inspiration that the human chemical body brought to it. But we'd moved into an impersonal world of post-literate identity, corporate tribal mass identities, and people pick their different corporate analog medium to attach themselves to, so that Watergate ended up being a battle between the newspaper and the television corporations over the advertising dollar. The advertising dollar was the ground. So you'll see that all these artists, Warhol, Patti Smith, Robert Mapplethorpe, they all become roadkill. They just get wiped out in the long run by the fact that advertising is the corporate ritual.
Yeah.
And who else? And Keith Richards, too. Yeah, he's
very torn, constantly torn between thinking they are artists and wanting to be creative and individualistic and everything, but then desperate to make some money.
Yeah.
So they always felt that they had to sell out. So then they spend their lives justifying the sellout.
That's right. And they end up writing books, and Dr. Dean reads them as patients. These are patients that come into Carol's life. Keith Richards, Andy Warhol, Bob Colicello, Patti Smith. Who else did you read? Sheila Watson. And who else are you reading? There's a couple other people. You can't remember?
No, I'm just looking at Robert Mapplethorpe's website.
Yeah, but who was that person you read? Sheila Watson.
The male, the yuppie.
Oh,
yuppie.
Paul Krasner. Paul Krasner. You did a patient analysis of him.
Mm-hmm.
And as usual, they are victims of magnesium deficiency at some point or other in their lives.
Yeah, they all starved. And when I read James Joyce's biography, he was starving in Paris. He was starving all over the place. He burnt out his stomach. He had all those stomach ulcers, which finally killed him just because he was starving.
Wyndham Lewis went blind. I say that Carolyn is the new artist in the sense of someone who is looking and x-raying the culture in a serious mode and coming up with hidden factors. And before, the Gutenberg artists kind of did that for a while. They came up with certain anti-environmental stances that people found a relief from whatever new environment was being imposed on them. So Carolyn is doing that job of x-raying from an informed scientific/artistic/medicinal position. Basically, you're up on all the information that most people can't keep up with.
Mm-hmm.
So then you got Carolyn Guertin, is trying to find what is the environment, what is the anti-environment, what is the critique of our situation, our society. She values critique. What is the role of that traditional individual artist or team of artists to produce some worthy critique? And she had to give up going for the object. It's a process that she's all about.
Right, and then what the artists seem to do, the next quote is still on page 123. It's about relational aesthetics.
Yes.
And the paragraph begins, appropriation art as, well, we don't know who this Levine
is. No, it's Les Levine. Les Levine.
But as Levine practiced it in the 1970s and 80s, has in turn been gradually eroded and replaced by a new school, the objectless relational aesthetics, which are social interactive collaborations. The kind of collaboration that relational aesthetics fosters is exemplified by artist Rurikrit, somebody or other. Where's he from? Gosh, I'll have to look him up. A two-person show with Andy Warhol. I don't know if he's South American or Asian. So anyway, why I bring this up is that you're talking about Gwerton trying to critique, and what the artists do is they just make new categories. So they've created this new relational aesthetics, and it only came up in 1998 where critic, curator, and historian, this Nicholas Bouriat, coined the term. And it's relational aesthetics, as I mentioned, the posing of an artist-constructed social experience as art-making is the latest step in the process of turning everything into art. So where I got the kind of definition of this is from a website where, you know, they talk about the standard cliché summary of modern and contemporary art is that now anything is art. And, you know, they say Jackson Pollock threw paint around, Duchamp strung up a shovel, upended a bike wheel into a stool and put a urinal on a pedestal and called the resulting three sculptures art of the highest order.
Okay, let me respond to that.
Yeah.
What you read was appropriation art as Levine practiced it in the 1970s, 1980s. Has in turn been gradually eroded and replaced by a new school, the objectless relational aesthetics, which are social interactive collaborations. Now, Levine, as Carolyn Gwerton means it here, is Sherry Levine, because I looked it up. That's the only Levine listed. But there was a Les Levine influenced by McLuhan, who was a major artist in that period, the 60s and 70s. So I thought that was who she meant, but she means some woman. But so they got object, no object. So they're agreeing with McLuhan when he says objects have no, objects are not observable.
Only relationships,
between. So relational aesthetics is what I would call the Android meme, art critic department, art philosopher, replaying what McLuhan already established in the early phases of the Android meme. Now, McLuhan says objects are only not observable, only relationship. When he makes a statement like that, it doesn't mean that he believes in it. He's saying that is the theme that will surface under electric conditions. People will start thinking up of ideas like objectless relational aesthetics. He's predicting that.
Mm-hmm.
So when McLuhan makes statements, he's saying this is the effect of a larger ground that people aren't aware of. So McLuhan himself collaborated in his books. So he did social interactive collaborations.
Mm-hmm.
So again, it goes back to process. And I remember way back in the late 60s, early 70s, people were getting sick of the word process. And they put it down for a while. And then, you know, 40 years later, we see that it's retrieved and accepted as a word in intellectual discussions of art. Carolyn Gwerton accepts process, but she's too young to know. If you use the word process in the 70s, partly because McLuhan made it famous, you would be kicked out. It was just too much of a cliche. So maybe the Android meme has made the word process acceptable. It's being replayed. So then they're talking about Tira Vent. You might want to go on mute, Carolyn.
Yeah, but I wanted to say he was born in Buenos Aires, but he is Thai. His parents, one was a diplomat and one is an oral surgeon. So he's a Thai parents. So that's where I
Thai descent
got mixed up. Yeah, go ahead, Bob.
So you have here the kind of collaboration that relational aesthetics fosters, is exemplified by artist Rukrit Tiruvanija. And he had a two-person show with Andy Warhol. And he was born in Buenos Aires of Thai descent. He currently lives in New York. And he won the 2010 Absolute Award. That's the vodka, I guess, Absolute, some kind of drink. And the 2005 Hugo Boss Prize offered by the Guggenheim Museum, along with many other honors. So here's something that... Here's a guy that 99% of humanity have never heard of, but in the cloistered art world, he has developed a certain success. So they.
And let me just say this: when you look him up in Wiki, and you Google for Warhol, Warhol doesn't even come up. So Wiki doesn't even think that what he did with Warhol was important. But this is where Gorton will, you know, she'll find something to sort of. Give an example to what she's trying to describe.
Yeah, that's what I'm going to read. So the press release described Tiruvanija's Warhol retrospective as follows. Quote, in 1994, Tiruvanija made/curated a two-person show with his other half, Andy Warhol. Now, Warhol was dead by then. It was a hybrid retrospective of sorts for each artist. Tiruvanija created a binary set of three pairs of work, with one work by each artist in each pair, a Mao and a stack of beer bottles, a Brillo box and a wok, Thailander wok, a bed and a pile of books and movies. Each pair created a metaphysical and cultural bridge across time and space from one world to another, each side looking at the other in the mirror and being disgusted at themselves. One side surfaced and mediated, the other dirty and touched, but both steeped in melancholia and necrophilia. So here's a description of this installation, of this setup, and Tiruvanija is hijacking the meme of Warhol and relating himself to the meme. That's all he can do. He has to take what's given, the environmental byproduct of advertising, formed Frank Zappa and Andy Warhol, and they came out of ads and tried to establish their own autonomy, but they end up being a included artifact within advertising. So advertising then sponsors this art form, and this new younger artist, he has to jump in and adapt himself to the memes, to the associations of Andy Warhol. So he's not working with individual originality. He's putting on environments and then positioning himself in relation to it, which is what McLuhan predicted, that the artist could only be a put-on starting from the 60s on. Sometimes they could be a takeoff, and he would say, what's the difference between a takeoff and a put-on? So now the term for this is social sculpture, all right? So she says after this press release by Tiruvanija, the practice of social sculpture has even found some footing in China, as with Al Weiwei's event at Documenta in 2007, when he invited 1,001 Chinese nationals to Castle, to the place where, I guess, Documenta was, as a social-political ready-made. So Warhol took the urinal and made that a ready-made. Duchamp took the urinal and made that a ready-made. Now, Weiwei, who is a famous Chinese artist, and he designed the main demonstration thing in the Chinese Olympics in 2008, and then was put in jail for it. I think he wasn't allowed to participate in the Olympics. He's too controversial. He puts on private political statements all the time, which irritates the corporate Chinese meme. So he invited 1,000 Chinese people to come as a socio-political ready-made. So 1,000 people as a ready-made. So it says, where Sherry Levine's audacious act of appropriation had blown notions of originality out of the water, to allow these artists back in the 70s, 80s, started to confront the idea that there was no originality in modernism, blah, blah, blah. But McLuhan explained that better than whatever they came up with, but they were riding that idea that, nobody can be original anymore. So she blew the known had blown notions of originality out of the water and forced us to reexamine authorship, mediated pop art. Then she says, mediated pop art, complicit with the numbing spectacle, set consumer culture up as an abstraction, as a theme for us to contemplate. See, the consumer culture, that's a code word for advertising. So they're trying to contemplate and be an anti-environment to the advertising takeover. With Warhol's pop art, there was no outside, and the act of representing a stolen image, although in Warhol's case he always paid for the rights to use the image, but the act of representing a stolen image was supposed to be an ironizing, make irony, comment on consumer culture. In actuality, though, representation immediately commodified the pop art critique, and any ironic distance was lost. Baudrillard, that's not Baudrillard, that's Baudrillard, argues that in the early 1980s, artists like Barbara Kruger critiqued the simulation of pop art, which set up the representation as a, quote, absolute commodity, where creation, in quotes, was a, quote, substitute for the act of consuming. Kruger's statement, I buy, therefore I am, sought to address this problematic lack of an outside in the framework. Now we're back to Tirvanisia's relational aesthetics-based recontextualization of Warhol's work is a non-consumer culture framed expose, a non-consumer culture framed expose of Western assumptions. In the shift, it is clear how there is no longer a one-to-one correspondence between works for Tirvanisia, as there had been for Levine. It is no longer just enough to start a conversation. There's the way, that's how you be an artist, you start a conversation. It is no longer just enough to start a conversation like the hidden message of gender relations and copies without originals in Levine's work. Tirvanisia introduces the genuine objects of Asian life that are pregnant with history and youth value, which underlines their lived-inness, their used nature, and foregrounds how steep these items are in Eastern scarcity and non-spectacularized politics.
So let me just intervene here. Yes, he's using Asian objects, and what's interesting about that is he was born in Buenos Aires. One of his parents was a diplomat, so maybe he was just searching for his Asian roots.
Yes, he decided what his eyes showed him, he believed them.
Yep.
He said, I look like a Thailander, so I must go back there. Mm-hmm. But this is a lot of complex esoteric stuff for the average five-bodied ecstatic. People are five-bodied ecstatics today. And this obscure little world of art left over for the chemical body, and they have to begin by saying, well, there is no chemical body.
Which brings up the next quote that I wanted to highlight.
Okay.
Page 124. It begins with French film director Jean-Luc Godard.
Yeah, I see that.
So the paragraph reads, French film director Jean-Luc Godard had greater insight than McLaren when viewing the new culture to be found on the web. Recognizing that the form is not a visual one, he said, quote, people make films on the internet to show that they exist, not in order to look at things. Isn't that cool?
Yeah, and that's what I've been calling for 30 years, producer mania.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, people were passive consumers in the industrial phase. Then the post-industrial phase started off by saying in the 60s, do your own thing. And then people found that their chemical body thing was so puny, they just retreated and waited for 10 years. Then the computer showed up, and then they started making things on the computer, making films and whatever. And that would be a hyper-producer mania. And you assert your identity by making something rather than looking and judging and evaluating and comparing it with someone else in a conversation or in a written article. So that's Jean-Luc Godard is explaining why his kind of film that he became famous for in the 50s, 60s is no longer relevant.
Right.
That people don't look at anybody's film. They just announce, especially in Web 2.0, that they have made something.
Well, Gwern sort of comments on it and expands it a bit. She says, this is a big departure in the shift from a visual to a dynamic or social culture. A YouTube clip, for instance, is a piece of information posted on the web that is designed to kickstart a conversation. That is what Pierre Baudet would call cultural capital. It is in the social engagement with a larger cultural framework that the form springs to life, acquires value, and fulfills its purpose as a social agent of personal identity. That's a bit dramatic, but she's saying what you said.
Yeah, no, so that someone posts something, and then they have to see how many likes they got on their Facebook.
True.
Or what kind of comments.
Right.
And if you get a good thread going, then you have a little bit of an identity for a few hours. But it comes from the audience. So the audience rules. The audience is the actor, and everybody takes turns being the producer and the audience. They
mm-hmm.
shift back and forth in the roles. That's why HCE in Finnegan's Wake is both a producer and a consumer.
Mm-hmm.
And that's Finnegan's Wake predicting what digital society created on a mass level.
Right.
You're looking for a bunch of people as a ready-made response to what you created. So that's what it means. Web 2.0 means that you engage in interruption, disturbance, and capture/leakage. These so-called objects are more accurately acts of self that perform the tripart formula of interruption, disturbance, and capture leakage. Now, that's what you've got here, right here on this show. You've got people doing that in the chat line, making comments. Let's check them, see what they're saying. Sean says, punk science, in the mind of God, good book discussing some of the conundrums faced by science, something called punk science. Augmenter says, warbling with his naked wood notes wild. Probably quoting for Finney's Wake. Yuri says, the new evolution is the new death. Then Yuri says, the interviewers/talk show hosts, they're investigative tinkerers of the chip body. Yes, anybody is. Anybody who's a member of Facebook is a tinkerer of the chip body.
Hmm. Now, what you were quoting right there, I had that highlighted with regard to the four laws of media, where interruption, disturbance, capture, and leakage, I was wondering if you could relate them to, you know, obsolescence, retrieval, the four laws.
Yeah, you can. So go on mute.
Okay.
So now this sentence that we were just reading, it is in the social engagement with a larger cultural framework that the form springs to life, acquires value, and fulfills its purpose as a social agent of personal identity. These so-called objects are more accurately acts of self that perform the tripart formula of interruption, disturbance, and capture/leakage. Now, this is where I am the god of that kind of world. I started that in the 80s. I came on and just started talking. And I created an audience. And then it turned out I was so good at it that I created, by talking, an anti-environment to the very situation and problem that Carolyn Gorton is puzzling about. And so I came in to see KLN, first with Bob Marshall. I threw him in as a canary in the mine. He lasted 3 years, and then they got rid of him. So then that left it open for me to come in. So Bob Marshall starts the interruption. He creates a disturbance, and then he's captured, and then he's leaked. But let's do it another way. So I come in and interrupted the dialogue by mentioning things that nobody was paying attention to in pattern recognition, not in the art world per se, not in the academic world, but in the early producers of pattern recognition, May Brussel, Dr. Beter, Sherman Skolnick, Frank Zappa, Marshall McLuhan, Herbert W. Armstrong, Lyndon LaRouche, Cosmic Awareness, Finnegan's Wake. These were the predictors, the acting out of the syndrome that Web 2.0 brought in. All right? So I was the curator of that. I presented these people in a talk show format that then went on to create a huge institution, which is called ION. So what was the tetrad of what I did? So I interrupted the social dialogue in a very tiny little place. When I first went on CKLN with Bob Marshall in 1984, it was broadcasting at 13 watts. They had a revolution in 84 and 85 at Ryerson School, where John Cage and Marcel Duchamp did their last chess game just before Duchamp died in 68, a few months later. You can see photos of that famous. Here's Cage and Duchamp, originators or anticipators of the mimic dialogue in the way they did their art, they show up at Ryerson, where I show up, you know, 20 years later, actually 16 years later, and create an interruption on a very tiny little broadcasting thing. And within a couple of years, they upped their broadcasting to 250 watts, fired Dave Neufeld, caused a reaction, and then that led to Bob Marshall being laid off, and then I came in with part two. So I created an interruption. That disturbed the old medium, which was the consumer of radio in Toronto, from the corporate stations to the University of Toronto station, the competitor to Ryerson, and all those other stations in between. They were disturbed, all right? So they were obsolesced. And more of them got made. More and more stations jumped into the fray because they thought, well, since Bob's disturbing them, maybe there's room for us. So you see, you enhance with interruption, you obsolesce with disturbance, because the medium is a message means the previous medium is what's disturbed by the interruption. And then you retrieve something from the past, you capture something, and then you flip into the opposite. You become a leak. You become an intelligence agency. So the retrieve part of capture, what was captured? We actually probably captured the very people I'm talking about. McLuhan, Herbert Armstrong, LaRouche, Phineas Wake. Those probes became archetypes. So we probe with them, and in the rapid turnover of the 80s, they quickly became archetypal retrievals. So then everybody started looking into Zappa, McLuhan, whoever was interested in what I was presenting. And then when you pushed me to extreme and they had to get rid of me from the station, I leaked my hidden agenda, which was the book Fatty Communion with Bob Dobbs. And then we went to New York City, and we continued to leak ourselves all over the place until finally the guff leaked out. And so then the guff became the new interruption, right? And I became the interruption for Web 2.0 and caused disturbance in the world that Carolyn Guertin is making an inventory of. And retrieved everything that could be known by humans in the mystery landscape, and then leaked into the present situation where we're in charge and we have certain technologies that were slowly leaking. All right, so you see how it works?
Okay, Bob. Yes, I'm real glad I asked about that. Very good.
All right.
Okay, the next focus is just the word lowbrow, how Guertin is using lowbrow, highbrow, throat. So is she getting that from the same sources you're getting, highbrow, lowbrow, and Manipian?
It comes from McLuhan's talk, art theory talk, Duchamp's work in the 20s, and Don Thiel is the professor of that. So lowbrow, highbrow is common awareness in the art world, that dialectic, starting in the 60s.
Mm. Okay, and what this topic is about is YouTube. And just to go through it a bit, I don't know if people know these facts, but in 2011, YouTube ranked globally as the number three most visited website after Google and Facebook. It was a primary mover in fostering the first big wave of lowbrow video cultural formulation. And so it makes sense to take a closer look, even if it's most of its contents are dreck through and through. I guess that's Gordon's opinion. She says ego clips are by far the largest category. I hadn't heard of ego clips, but that's like selfies, I guess. Or, no, a selfie is just a picture. An ego clip is where someone is making a video of themselves. And that includes everything from pop star Justin Bieber's karaoke videos, which gave him his start, to sporting accidents, to personal travelogues. And then she talks about being outside the economy. Part of these YouTube videos' cachet is in the fact that they operate outside of the economy of exchange and often do so with appropriated or shared materials. So because it got so huge, Google bought it 11 months into the YouTube in 2006, and then Google started to use copyright on the content. So YouTube uses a manual copyright takedown notice under the Digital Millennium Copyright Act system delivered via a copyright complaint form available to anyone who wishes to request the removal of a particular video. This generally happens without discussion, only with a statement of violation, and is done without attention to the rights to enforce the law or exceptions to the rules like parody or fair use. So, I mean, it's mainly just her basis of the whole digital prohibition is exemplified by this YouTube, Google copyright takedown. Any comment?
No, that is the environment that she's concerned about. The legislation, the lying, the misuse of the copyright takedown notice or the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. So that's her grievance in the book. So she's trying to find out what's valuable to counter that. What is providing a critique of this corporate takeover?
Right, and one of YouTube's software engineers, Mary Gould Stewart, claims that YouTube is empowering content owners by providing a culture of opportunity where progressive rights management and new technology offer an alternative to simply blocking all reuse of intellectual property. So she argues, you know, how important this is, but then Guertin says she does not point out that all of this is in strict violation of fair use laws, which corporations are encouraged to ignore. Fair use laws are pretty much under siege everywhere and for the most part keep losing ground in the courts. So it's, you know, the big, the man, you know, the big corporation just giving a bunch of, with a newspeak to try to pretend like they're saving the environment, kind of like what Monsanto does when it makes the GMO, saying it's actually saving our lives and not the opposite.
Right. So this is where you bring in Donald Theo's dialectic of synesthesia and co-anesthesia. And there's been a dead heat between them for 30 or more years. So co-anesthesia, in a simple way, is the drive towards centralizing and integration, and then everybody agreeing, wow, we've arrived at a solution, a corporate solution that we can all get behind, and we can no longer refuse getting along, right? Why can't everybody get along? So you have the trend of co-anesthesia happening in the Android meme. At the same time, you have the fragmentation, the spiraling off, the producer mania, the orbiting into your own cycles of synesthesia. So centralization and decentralization both continue at the same time, and neither of them wins. This is the great thing about the Android meme, is that nobody can establish a victory. And Carolyn Guertin spends a lot of time in the book showing the move toward horrible 1984 Big Brother suppression and prohibition, but she also points out how it never gets to be effective. It never gets to be a product and a final solution, because the synesthesia, hallucination, mixed media resources and archives that people can come up with can't be controlled. So there's always a spiraling off. And someone posted on my Facebook a picture of the Dobbs head. So you have the big pipe-smoking Dobbs head based on my father. And then you go into each little dot that the big Dobbs head is made up of, and they're all little Dobbs heads. So the big organized icon, like at the end of Matrix 3, remember when Neo confronts this formation, this digital formation at the end, it's forming and pretending to be a frightful mean, M-I-E-N, frightful appearance, frightful mean, and but doesn't have any staying power. It doesn't stay very long. A few people freak out. They get brain surgery. They go on meds. They suffer this fear mechanism, like the announcement of a new virus or a new bird flu or something. It spreads across the culture for a few weeks, and idiots succumb to it. But others spiral off in their own coast-to-coast inspired disgust at the corporate Illuminati conspiracy to integrate everything. And so they spiral off and create commentary in all the websites and all the common and all the forums, and a Finneganese of millions of people expressing themselves or outrage at the centralized co-anesthetic direction. And it's synesthetic in response, because everybody is not on the same page in what they think they're objecting to. Okay? Just go to your magnesium advocacy. There's so many different crazy views about where we are at with magnesium. That's an example of hallucinatory synesthesia in the audience's mind, in the co-producer's mind. So the interplay of co-anesthesia and synesthesia is the abstract relationship one has to understand to get what ION is about. ION is about co-anesthesia interplaying with synesthesia. ION says, we are taking over, and either get happy or get out. But at the same time, encourages everybody to ignore ION and create their own space, right? So ION advocates synesthesia while pretending to create co-anesthesia. So this is what this dialectic is not mentioned by anybody other than Donald Thiel. But I'm using it, so it has a life of its own.
Excellent, Bob.
So did that trigger off anything in what you were looking at? That did I remind you of anything?
Nope. No, it was a complete thought in and of itself.
I think, I'm not sure, this may be something.
Mm.
The Electronic Frontier Foundation, an American nonprofit for civil liberties of digital technologies and online use, claims, quote, the lifeblood of much of this new creativity, that would be synesthesia, is fair use. The copyright doctrine that permits unauthorized uses of copyrighted material for transformative purposes. Creators naturally quote from and build upon the media that makes up our culture, yielding new works that comment on, parody, satirize, criticize, and pay tribute to the expressive works that have come before. The expressive works that have come before. These forms of free expression are among those protected by the American Fair Use Doctrine. So that's what the original protector of fair use, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, said. Then Guertin says, in fact, even the chairman of the Electronic Frontier Foundation made his own synesthetic spiraling off critique of the situation, and it was called Downfall. And then she says, I'll discuss that later in the chapter. Many of the videos, says Guertin, that have been challenged have now been returned by following the correct channels to appeal YouTube's removal of the content, and many more new videos continue to be uploaded. So it goes back to this interruption. So everybody dances, the synesthesias dance on the co-anesthesias toe, and the co-anesthesias dance on the synesthesias toe. So each other is dancing, and each makes a little inroad for a minute or two, and then is countered. So everything is being canceled out. There's no direction, and this canceling out, what McLuhan called a rapid series of ersatz, or fake anti-environments, or fake innovations, serves as a fake anti-environment. Because there never was an issue that was going to be threatening to everybody at the beginning. There are just little pulses of panic, and then it ends up to have a non-existent issue. It never did cause anything of any resolution on either the synesthesia side or the co-anesthete side. And so that is the Android meme world. It has nothing to do with chemical body evaluation and identity. You cannot get identity in relation to the Android meme. It will cancel anything you thought was about you, and it itself is canceling itself always. And Guertin occasionally comes up with a quote or two or a statement or some prose she writes that looks at that kind of intuits that. I don't know if you've come to them yet, those quotes.
Right. I mean, it's, what, a 400-page book? We're still on 127.
Well, we've only done a few pages.
Yeah, we've just, we have not done every page. No. The next is about the most visible and widely protested example of the abuse of these rights by corporations are the parodies of Oliver Hirschbiegel's critically acclaimed 2004 film, Downfall. So this is, you've already mentioned that the EFF head did a Downfall
parody.
Parody, thanks. And what it is, it's the Hitler rant that a lot of people know about. I got it. Someone sent me the Hitler rant ages ago, won the INET. And what it is, it's a scene in this film, Downfall, where it's Bruno Goetz's rendition of Adolf Hitler as he blows a gasket when his generals inform him that the war is lost. And Gwerton says the popularity of this as remixed material no doubt stems in part from the fact that the only changes the parodies make is that they alter the subtitles and alter them so they follow what Gantz and his generals say as closely as possible. But what's, I just didn't quite get, what is that, why, and who is widely protesting this? An abuse. I mean, who's abused? I don't feel abused.
All right, so let me read a bit further. So you mute. So you have the generals giving Hitler a bad name or a bad conclusion to the war, and he's really pissed off. So the parodies changes so that Hitler is blowing up over many different slights, insults, and omissions. Hitler loses it when Michael Jackson dies, when the iPad is revealed not to have multitasking. When Hitler learns of the downfall parodies of themselves, he loses it. And when Hitler learns that Constantine film, the copyright holder, is taking down the downfall parodies. So it goes meta, meta, meta. In 2010, Constantine asked YouTube to remove all of the parodies. I guess he had something to do with the original film, 2004 film called Downfall. He said, so Gwerton says that the parodies were unauthorized is without question. Does Constantine have the right to remove them, even if they are harming the film's reputation or taking too much of Constantine's energy to monitor? From the beginning, Constantine has issued cease and desist orders under the DMCA for an embarrassing appropriation, according to Andrew Clay, and they've also been hit with complaints about the other products or technologies that have been satirized, especially for the Microsoft Xbox Live version, which received more than 4 million hits and protested Microsoft's habit of shutting down Xboxes for infringement of copyright. So Constantine has been heavily criticized for its move to suppress the parodies. YouTube's unprecedented creative energy is in jeopardy from this abuse of the system. And then that's when the Electronic Frontier guy comes in, and then he made his own parody. Then it says, many of the videos that have been challenged have now been returned. So there's a big uproar. Some corporate guy tried to bring in co-anesthesia and make everybody fit one solution, one conclusion. It sort of lasted for a few weeks and then stopped, and then the synesthesia took over. So let's see. What is there some kind of statement about it?
Is it on the next page about free expression? Creators naturally quote from and build upon the media that makes up our culture, yielding new works that comment on, parody, satirize, criticize, pay tribute to the expressive works that have come before. These forms of free expression are among those protected by the American fair use doctrine.
So this is what McLuhan meant in the 60s about the participation mystique. The point is everybody's engaged in process, talking and taking stances and interrupting other people or disturbing them, and there's no finish line, as McLuhan said at the end of his 1970 book, Culture's Our Business. And this is what maybe James Joyce understood in Finnegan's Wake. So all of these issues are already acted out in Finnegan's Wake. And that's where Don Thiel comes in and criticizes, if he was alive, he criticized Gwerton's book, he criticized Croker, Bogart. They do not point out the fact that Hitler got there first, and James Joyce responded wisely with Finnegan's Wake, and that might not be important. It is not important to know that, but nothing is of itself anything. So it is important to know that.
Well, where Finnegan's Wake came up for me was further ahead in page 133, 134, about the CAPTCHA, the reflexive remix that Gabrielle de Vinitri did. She called it CAPTCHA, and it's derived from the online security device called CAPTCHA, designed to thwart spam bots from posting information on websites. So what Devitri did was take all these nonsense words and crafted a whole new world from them. And she tells a dystopic story of strange creatures in a hostile land in a five-minute voiceover narrated video that displays only keywords from the security program. And she goes on and tells a story of this meadow and red mutes and Boswell and the cob dobs and on and on. And to me, that's where Gwerton should have said, as in Finnegan's Wake, but she calls it more Alice Through the Looking Glass. Yeah, Carol's Jabberwocky, but to me it's pretty much Finnegan's Wake. I wondered what you thought of that.
Well, James Joyce built on Lewis Carroll's work and took it way further, and so it's better to state Finnegan's Wake as the source of this, because Joyce completed the probes by Carroll and company back in the 19th century, and the symbolists and other people, other avant-garde artists, and moved it into a whole new perception that even the avant-garde establishment couldn't recognize. Around the Fusion Gang. So, Fusion, what was that called? The Fluxus artists in the 60s, Yoko Ono and buddies. The thing is that the making of new devices from word recombinations, that was happening here?
Correct.
Yeah, that is already spelled out as an operation that the modern digital producer maniac can do, that was anticipated by Finney's Wake. Finney's Wake does provide you with material to make and retrieve anything you want to in producer mania. So as the digital technology allows anybody to do this, it's interesting to know that Finney's Wake did it first, and the consequences of that knowledge we have to wait for. That has not become a general understanding yet. But once Finnegan's Wake is understood, what does that create? Massive boredom? Is that like legalizing marijuana? Does it become dull? And therefore, the whole agenda of autonomous, digerati anarchists trying to critique the image archive becomes irrelevant. And that is where we're at. That's what Iandom is. Iandom is post-digital exhaustion. We have an experience, an interesting interaction, participatory with Ion. Ion wants everybody to start talking to it, and through it is the actual punchline to this whole non-punchline process that's been going on for 30, 40 years. So that's the good news. We actually did arrive at an object that can be probed inside out, and that's Ion itself, the guff, the heaven that we all died into in the old days. The heaven has come forth to present itself as the last object for us to use as a political football to bash around and have fun with. And we are going to end with that, I think, Carol. I think we've had enough today.
Well, just one quick thing, sidebar almost. On page 129, Quirt talks about the largest crowdsourcing project to date, sponsored by YouTube and National Geographic, produced by our buddy Ridley Scott. So,
Ridley Scott's brother started to make a movie called Ion around 2010, but unfortunately got affected by our operation so much he committed suicide, jumped off a bridge or something, leaving Ridley holding the bag of the Good Wife TV show and to keep that going.
So did we ever ask Ion, did he jump off a bridge into another world, or did he blow it and miss the portal?
I don't recall talking to Ion too much about it.
Mm.
It was sort of blatantly obvious, or Ion didn't want to talk about it. I can't remember, but
okay.
I'm sure Bart or somebody will come up with the particular show where it is talked about and make a little mashup from it. So we can look forward to that.
Okay, good. So, yes, we've come to the hour. We almost finished everything that I had brought forth. So thank you very much, Bob, for your elucidation.
And thank you for your probing. Any interruption, disturbance, capture, leakage, and
especially the leakage.
Yeah, and all-round engagement. Now, there's from ORA, ORA says, a lot of copyright detection is now automated, and YouTube actually uses algorithms to recognize visual audio patterns and compare against a huge studio database. Yes, Bill here at Achieve Radio has to deal with that speed of the cloning of ESP.
Yes, and Gwerton does mention that. That's true.
What does she mention?
That they have huge algorithms that just constantly troll any new content. And then they even go into a person's website, too, once they get access.
Well, that's a way of understanding what I'm saying about the Android meme. It took over 30 or so years ago, and it's the Android meme policing itself. We actually have nothing to be concerned about. Now, that can be quite depressing for most people, and that's where Ion comes in to counter that depression. Like, Gwerton's going to have to realize the obsolescence of her old enterprise here, and then what's she going to do? You know, how's she going to live? You're describing the Android meme policing itself, ORA, and that's a good example. This whole book is a good example of the Android meme policing itself, and we, fortunately, are not involved. All of us, none of us are involved in that. Just temporarily, when you try to be a co-anesthetic or a synesthete, you take sides, you'll have a little contrast. Okay, so I think, and then Augmenter ends with maybe a quote from Finnegan's Wake, ca, cop, copy, op, p, peer, ear, right. So he's breaking down the word copyright. Ca, cop, copy, op, p, peer, ear, right. Okay, thanks a lot there, Augmenter. So this ends the Gwerton portion of the show.